But yes, there is definitely cause for optimism. And as I keep telling myself, the more ham-fisted the propaganda is, the blunter their messaging is, the sooner people will see through it. So yeah, keep it up. Just keep doing it.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, and I have a special conversation lined up for you today with a new guest on the program, Irina Slav, who I know will be familiar to some listeners, if only because I have seen Corbett Report member Home Remedy Supply posting links to Irina Slav's oilprice.com articles for a number of years in the comment section now. So I've been aware of Irina's work for several years now. And if you're new to it, well, there are several places that you can go. One is the aforementioned oilprice.com, and I'll put a link up to her author page there. But as I am ashamed to just have recently discovered, she's also on Substack. I did not know that. But yes, she's also at irinaslav.substack.com. So I will put that link in the show notes as well. But let's welcome her onto the program. Irina Slav, thank you for coming on The Corbett Report.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's good to meet you. So, as I say, I have been following your writing at oilprice.com for a number of years now. But for people who are new to you and your writing, tell us a little bit about yourself, why and how you got into writing about energy in particular and other things besides, and what your background is.
Well, it kind of happened by accident. I had a friend who worked at a data processing company, which meant writing news, among other things. And they were looking for someone to cover the energy industry of Russia and the former Soviet Union. And I was the person, apparently. And when I started writing about energy, oil and gas exclusively at the time, I found out it was really interesting. And so it went. I stayed with that company for a few years. And after I left, I started freelancing and I got in touch with oilprice.com. And I've been writing almost exclusively about energy for what, about 10 years now.
So you're based specifically in Eastern Europe, is that right?
I'm in Bulgaria.
Yeah. And but you write about the global energy markets.
Oh, I write about everything energy, yeah.
And well, today we're going to be talking quite specifically about a certain type of information that you and I and everyone else in this space has to deal with, which is propaganda, which is being shoved down everyone's throats all the time and through many different outlets. So today we're going to concentrate specifically on a very interesting article. As I say, this is the article through which I found out you have a Substack. I believe it was whatsupwiththat.com had a link to this article. So
right,
I followed it back to your Substack
to
discover, oh, Irina Slav is here. So it's called Burn Hollywood Burn. And it starts with you relating about a conversation that you had on X, formerly Twitter, talking about how you thought we've reached peak idiocy with regards to the transition narrative. But, oh boy, we never say we've reached peak idiocy because there will always be something to prove you wrong. Tell us about the idiocy that came along to prove you wrong on that bold statement.
Well, for starters, I want point out that this is a quote. I'm not wishing for Hollywood to burn down into the ground. It's a quote from a song, Open Up, by Left Field, featuring Johnny Lydon. But the article that drew my attention more pointedly to the issue of propaganda in the entertainment industry was one in Rolling Stone, where the author was really enthusiastically talking about how there are organizations and groups that are trying to make every single movie or TV show about the climate. I really should stop saying that we've reached peak idiocy because there are more peaks to conquer. Apparently, this was a good thing. You know, what amazed me was that the author of this article saw absolutely nothing wrong about inserting climate change into every single story, particularly through one organization that is consulting filmmakers, producers, directors, everyone involved in the show business, on how to insert the climate change into their narratives. It's really, truly amazing the level that propaganda has reached.
It's amazing only insofar as how out in the open it is at this point, I think. Specifically, we're referring to a Rolling Stone article called How Hollywood is Crafting a New Climate Change Narrative that came out on RollingStone.com on February 22nd, 2024. It's penned by Melissa June Rowley, so I will throw the link in if people want to read this article and see what we're talking about. But essentially, yes, it is talking about how Hollywood is, there's groups and organizations and teams that are dedicated to inserting more and more climate change propaganda into Hollywood to make everyone scared to their wit's end at all times about the coming end of humanity or something along those lines for good reasons, I guess. And specifically, as you point out,
make some money out of it.
Well,
too.
Yes, I mean, quite cynically, but I would trust that people in my regular audience understand that. But yes, thank you for pointing that out. Of course, as I certainly believe, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but I imagine that you are on board with this idea that so much of this hype and scare is about, at the very least, yeah, drumming up money. But I think
absolutely.
Other Malthusian ulterior motives besides.
Yeah.
Right. But, okay, so let's concentrate. As you mentioned, they point out one specific group in here called Good Energy, which I see you made some witty remarks about their interestingly designed website. But getting past that, who is Good Energy and who is behind Good Energy and what are they attempting to do?
You and your audience wouldn't be surprised to learn that the people behind and the organizations behind this Good Energy are the usual philanthropists that, finance all sorts of climate change initiatives and NGOs and other businesses like that, I'm sure. But there was Bloomberg Philanthropies, I forget the names, but it's basically the usual suspects, a lot of them. It's a clique, you know, they finance the same organizations trying to push the climate change narrative and the degrowth narrative onto the masses while they themselves either make money from the whole thing by charging, I'm sure, pretty handsomely for their consultancy services in the case of Good Energy. You know, it's all about money. Although I'm sure that among the billionaires behind those philanthropic organizations, they probably have a sense of altruism about doing it. Or maybe it's a form of buying indulgences, as someone suggested to me a while ago, because their lifestyles are not exactly compatible with a degrowth narrative.
Mm. Right. Yeah. So I think there are several levels on which this works. And I guess it depends on which level of the propaganda people buy into. And one of the levels is, I really do think there is a sort of religious analogy that really does apply here, that people really believe they can buy their carbon indulgences to appease the weather gods so that they won't go to climate hell. It lines up on so many different levels that it's beyond just an analogy. I think there's something actually really pointing to something deeply psychologically rooted going on there. Then there are other people who are just in it for the cash grab. Hey, there's a big new $1 trillion transition market that's opening here, so we can get in on that. And then there are other people who I think genuinely have a Malthusian bent to them that truly do want to see less humans on this planet. And I think there's that impetus behind it.
Themselves. You know, they want to see fewer people on the planet. They want to see the population, but they never lead by example. Mm. Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
That is very strange.
Yeah, like Ted Turner wants to see the human population reduced to 300 million, but he has 5 children and however many hundreds of acres of land himself. But that's fine.
Right. It's different. I'm sure it's different. You know, the justification. This is different. But you know what concerns me the most? That I believe that only a tiny minority are only in it for the money. I think the overwhelming majority of these people involved in pushing the climate propaganda actually genuinely believe it is an existential threat. They believe they have a mission. Here we go with another religious parallel. To, you know, open the eyes of the masses and teach them to be afraid and to do more about the climate, whatever this might mean, you know, to avoid this existential threat, this highway to hell, as the head of the UN.
And the road to hell is paved with good intentions and people who truly do believe the propaganda that they're pushing. The reason I don't find this story, the essence of this story, surprising is because I remember 15 years ago when Fox put out it. Well, an internal video was released that they had put out themselves about how they were deliberately inserting climate change messages into all of their programming, and they were bragging about this. This is our, you know, we're a good corporate citizen. This is what Rupert Murdoch's empire is doing. So I have seen this happening for many years now. It's just interesting that it's now being touted because, of course, it's part of the climate virtue signaling that's going on right now. You point to a specific example in your article of a trailer for the first, what is it, TV series or whatever it is right now that is specifically about climate change issues. Tell us about that.
What was it? Extremities? No, it wasn't
Extrapolations.
Extrapolations. Yeah. I'm sorry. I've suppressed the memory. Well, it was a bit difficult to watch because it was really dripping with drama and a sense of impending doom. What I noticed before I really started laughing, because they had overdone the drama, definitely. You know, they tend, these people, these climate propaganda pushers, they tend to overdo it on the quantity at the expense of the quality. But I noticed, and you've probably noticed too, it was full of stars. It was full of big names, well-known names. I don't think there was anyone that I haven't seen before many times.
I certainly noticed Edward Norton right away. In your article, you said it was difficult to get to the end without bursting out laughing. And I thought, oh, I can do that challenge. And I tried, and nope, I had to turn it off. And I think you're exactly right. The propaganda is so heavy-handed and so obviously bluntly they're hitting you over the head with it that the art is sacrificed. If they were creating great, slick art that actually drew people into a story and subtly inserting this, that could actually be effective. But they're not doing that.
I know. It's like hitting you with a hammer on the head. It's a thinly veiled propaganda message masked as art or entertainment, which it isn't. And I could only guess what made all these stars sign up for this. Probably they're very climate conscious as well. I see no other explanation. And they think they're doing good. You know, this really annoys me that a lot of people involved in the climate crusade, as I call it, they really do think they're doing good when they aren't. They're doing the opposite of good. Because if I show this TV show to my 12-year-old daughter and I hadn't talked to her about climate change and the whole hysteria, she would buy it. Young people would buy it. They would believe it.
Well, when Leonardo DiCaprio flies into Davos to lecture the peons about how you have to eat bugs to save the planet and on his private jet, I'm sure he believes what he's saying, but he's not going to do it himself.
It's different. You know, they once asked Bill Gates, why does he fly with a private jet? And he basically said, this is different because I'm giving billions to fight climate change. Well, that's all right then.
All right. Well, this actually leads to an interesting place, because not only did I discover that you have a Substack in which you're writing about the type of energy-related things that you write about at oilprice.com, but I noticed you're also a fiction writer, which I did not know about, and you have a fiction Substack as well. So you're not just talking about this critique of art from some sort of, you know, economic point of view or oilprice.com writer point of view, but as an actual fiction writer yourself. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it's actually, thank you for bringing this up, because as a writer, I noticed a few years ago a new subgenre emerging, climate fiction, cli-fi, in which I think authors, again, very heavily lean on the apocalyptic, on the dystopian, on a ruined planet and what we can do about it. I've never actually had the courage to try and read any of those books. But I write supernatural stories. I'm an English philologist by degree, so I've studied a lot of fiction. And I still believe that good fiction is a good story. It's not about messaging. It's about a good story that is told as best as the author can. So it's really frustrating to see politics, energy, politics and propaganda, you know, make their way into literature as well, with all these new genres emerging and new sort of writing that delivers a message rather than telling a story. What I try to do is just tell stories, stories that I find interesting, whether or not anybody else finds them interesting, well, that's not up to me. But I enjoy writing.
It provides an interesting perspective, doesn't it? I also come from a creative writing background. I wanted to be a fiction writer back way before I started into all of this and became whatever I am now, a podcaster. So I'm particularly rankled by just the heavy-handed nonsense propaganda that they put out. But in a sense, I find that to be actually hopeful. Because, as you point out towards the end of your article, it's so bad, it's so blatant what they are attempting to do, that most people probably aren't going to fall for it. As you say, young, impressionable people might fall into the trap. But for people who have read a thing or two or watched a movie or two in their time, I don't think that this flat, lifeless, heavy-handed melodrama is really going to really have its intended effect.
No, it's not. We see it with identity politics, identity messaging in fiction. It's losing steam. People no longer want to read stories with a certain set of characters just because they must be included in the story. They want to read the story. So interest towards this heavily identitarian fiction is waning. And I think the same will happen with movies and TV shows, because when I watch a TV show or a movie, I want to watch a story, just like when I read a book, I want it for the story. I don't want not so subtle messaging. You know, I can draw conclusions and I can interpret the story however I please. And I think this will happen in movie and TV shows as well. But I am worried about the younger generations because, as you say, they are impressionable. And if they get indoctrinated with these ideas from an early age, it will be very hard to change that later on in life. And they will be wondering where did we go wrong with this transition? Why is it not happening? Why is everyone poor and unhappy? Why is there no electricity? You know, it was supposed to be great, but it's not, because it cannot be. It can't work.
You know, it does kind of raise the question, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but given that we both have literary inclinations and backgrounds, what would be some fiction, or even nonfiction, that you think has addressed the subject of man and the environment and our relationship to the environment in a way that is actually fruitful and interesting to explore? And I'm thinking of all sorts of things, from something like a Robinson Crusoe to Walden to State of Fear by Michael Crichton, which I haven't read, but I should, because I know that it provides an interesting kind of the opposite mirror image to the cli-fi that they're trying to shove down the public's throats right now. I could think of probably several others, but is there anything that springs to your mind?
Well, the first thing that springs to mind would be A History of the World in 10.5 Chapters by Julian Barnes.
I haven't read that.
You should. Mm. It's really great. It's really great. And it has the 10 chapters, which tell different stories, many of which are, in fact, about humankind and its environment and culture and civilization and whatnot. And there was actually a chapter that describes the fictional environmental crisis. But it's done well. It is not done with the purpose of sending a message. He's just telling a story, and he's great at telling stories, Julian Barnes.
And now that I'm thinking about it,
back in the 90s,
right? So. Okay, I will definitely add that to my reading list. I've read something of Barnes, but I can't remember what book I read. But at any rate, I will add that to my reading list. And now that I'm thinking about it, I know Dune is in the media news at the moment, and that is certainly a book that has to do with shaping environment. So anyway, interesting theoretical.
Or adjusting to your environment, if you think about it. There's a lot about adaptation.
Right.
And adaptation is a taboo word for the climate crusaders, because apparently it cannot work. It's not good enough.
Right.
Some author openly, some activists, climate activists, openly rejected the idea. No, we cannot rely on adaptation. No, we must transition. Why can't we rely on adaptation? This is how we've survived for
I'm just imagining Frank Herbert in 2024 writing Dune, and it would be some, you know, climate allegory and how we're ruining the weather, and oh my god, it would be so terrible. But yes, that I think that is the point, and I think that is the positive takeaway from this. One thing that I always note to my audience at every chance that I can is the fact that they spend billions and billions and billions of dollars every year propagandizing to you through every available media outlet and every channel shows that they do care what goes on in your mind, that you actually do have a lot of power just by perceiving and understanding the world in a way that they don't like. That can rankle them to the point where they spend all of this time and energy and effort trying to propagandize you. That's because you are important. And similarly, when they try in this ham-handed, ham-fisted way to try to shove these types of propaganda and messages into art, ruining the art in the process, in a sense, that is I think a hopeful sign that people are going to reject this, and people are going to be gravitate towards stories that actually have something to say about the human condition. Or am I just being overly optimistic there?
I don't think you are, because human civilization is about storytelling. It's an essential, a core part of human culture and civilization. It's part of evolution. We evolved, including through telling each other stories, because we had language to do this. So we like stories, especially stories we can relate to. Yeah, sure, we like to be scared, but up to a point, you can't keep being scared. You will get tired of it sooner or later, or you'll get mad and start gluing yourself to the road. But I think your optimism is justified, and I share it with some suspicion, because I don't really have high expectations from my fellow human beings, especially those in charge. But yes, there is definitely cause for optimism. And as I keep telling myself, the more ham-fisted the propaganda is, the blunter their messaging is, the sooner people will see through it. So yeah, keep it up.
Just yeah. Go on, good energy. Do your worst. Yeah. Excellent. And in a sense, I think we are already starting to see the beginnings of this with the farmer revolts that are going on right now in Europe and elsewhere. I think people are starting to realize, oh, this agenda really is coming for us. It really is total BS. And I think people are starting to stand up against it. But what's your perspective there from Eastern Europe?
I totally agree. I mean, politicians in Europe try to target food supply, which is never a good idea. But they grew so arrogant and so confident that whatever they do, people will just swallow it and ask for more. Or if not, just roll over and take it, which the farmers didn't. And good for them. I really hope the protests continue until those in power start to, you know, really asking themselves some questions, such as, are we really doing the right thing? Is it safe for us? Because it's not.
Yes. You know, actually, this brings to mind another article that I saw on your Substack recently. Let's eat each other, in which you're talking about a related, I guess, type of weird propaganda that's being inserted into the media right now regarding food. Not the eat the bugs agenda, which we know also, of course, exists, but eat each other agenda. What are you talking about?
Well, it's very fringe. It's like this idea is making its first steps towards the mainstream, but I think if left alone, it will enter the mainstream. It was about some science article in, New Scientist, yes, about discovery of human skeletons a few thousand years old that had traces of, I suppose, human teeth. I mean, there was evidence that they were eaten by other humans. And according to the archaeologists that made this discovery, or at least studied it, these people were probably not eaten out of brutality and hate, but out of love and compassion. You cannot prove this. It's speculation. And yet, apparently, they're trying to push this idea that it might be humane to eat carcasses, human carcasses. Mm. and good for the planet, I'm sure. But we haven't got to that point. So,
but as you say, it is starting to crop up. And this is something I have noticed. I have noticed for the last several years, there have been a number of stories in the news cycle that come up time and time again that point in the direction of cannibalism. And maybe, is this taboo really a taboo? Should it be a taboo? In weird ways. And you point out, in fact, even a recent sort of art project hoax about lab-created human meat was then covered by the BBC as in, oh no, it's just a hoax. But that in itself is embedding in the public consciousness the idea of cannibalism.
Absolutely. No, the BBC was about a movie, a spoof movie about growing steaks from human tissue. At least that wasn't about eating corpses, but it was about eating human tissue. Why would you go and invest billions into a lab that creates steaks from human tissue? I don't know. It's worthy Margaret Atwood in her good years. That conceptual art project actually had nothing to do with cannibalism. It was about how easily people accept terms and conditions by websites. So why do you use cannibalism themed concepts to, send this message? Very peculiar choice, I thought.
It really is. It really is. And yes, it's a kind of a leap from the climate change agenda that they're inserting. But I think there is some sort of relation going on, because it is about control of resources on the planet generally and getting people to accept more and more tightly controlled food supply, for example. And the Eat the Bugs agenda is definitely part of that. And,
yes, it's a big part of that.
And yes, breaking down the big taboo against cannibalism is apparently part of this agenda.
Very, very circular economy. Actually, I really don't like waste. I'm a very big opponent of waste of any kind. But, even I draw the line at eating human corpses or any parts of human corpses.
I'll side with you on that one. All right. Well, as I say, okay, so great. You have a Substack, and now I'm subscribed, so I can find out what you're writing about there as well. And I hope people out there will subscribe too, or at least take a look at it, or certainly take a look at these articles that we're talking about today, which I will link up in the show notes. But is there any other resources or anything else you'd like to direct people to with regards to this conversation?
Right now, no. I'm most active on Oil Price and on Substack. I'm even a bit too active on Substack, but... Well,
excellent. And you've even added a book to my literary reading list. So thank you for that.
Oh, great.
Anyway, I hope we can talk again in the future. But thank you for your time tonight. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thank you, James.